From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
CIA has not used waterboarding for almost 5 years. We used it against these three high-value detainees because of the circumstances of the time.
CIA Director Michael Hayden admitting the CIA waterboarded three prisoners since 9/11, all three of them named in the 9/11 Commission report. NBC News revealed last week the commission had long suspected the information used for its report was the product of harsh interrogations. Yet staffers did not question the CIA about its techniques, and the commission even ordered a second round of interrogations. We'll be joined by the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, Philip Zelikow, as well as Robert Windrum, the NBC News reporter who broke the story, and Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. But first, Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have emerged from Super Tuesday in a virtual dead heat. We'll take a look at the race for delegates and superdelegates. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As the race for the White House intensifies, Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are scrambling to raise more money in what's already projected to be the most expensive election ever. On Wednesday, Clinton revealed she personally loaned her campaign $5 million last month. According to Time magazine, the campaign shortage of cash has forced some staff members of the Clinton campaign to forego pay this month, including campaign manager Patty Solis Doyle. In 2007, both Clinton and Obama raised over $100 million, but Obama outfundraised Clinton in January when he pulled in over $32 million to her $14 million. The Obama campaign has claimed it has raised another $6.6 million in online donations since Super Tuesday. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the Democratic and Republican candidates have already spent nearly $500 million, more than every election in U.S. history except 2004. On Tuesday, both Senators Clinton and Obama attempted to claim to be the winner of Super Tuesday.
2 weeks ago, we were trailing Senator Clinton in some national polls by as much as 20 points. Last night, we won more delegates and we won more states in every region of this country. We won big states and small states. We won red states and we won blue states and we won swing states. So I believe that we had an extraordinary night. It was a big victory for our campaign.
The Obama campaign says the Illinois senator will wind up with slightly more delegates from Super Tuesday, but the Clinton camp has rejected that claim.
We had a great night last night with victories across the country, and ending up once again with a total of more votes and more delegates and lots of energy from voters who decided that they really needed a president on day one to be able to manage the economy and provide the leadership that is going to be required to deal with the problems facing our country.
According to CNN, Clinton had a slight edge over Obama in the popular vote on Super Tuesday. Of the 14.6 million Democratic voters who voted Tuesday, 50.2% backed Clinton, 49.8% backed Obama. In the Republican race, Senator John McCain's expected to reach out to the party's conservative base today when he addresses CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee. On Wednesday, McCain vowed to unite the Republican Party.
We'll be hitting the campaign trail tomorrow morning, flying back this afternoon, and hopefully we can wrap this thing out, unite the party, and be ready to take on the Democratic nominee in November.
In California, the acting Los Angeles County Registrar has announced his office will examine more than 94,000 ballots cast on Tuesday following an uproar from voters who fear their votes will not count. And California independent voters are allowed to take part in the Democratic or the American Independent Party primaries. In Los Angeles County, these nonpartisan voters are given a special ballot where they must pick a candidate and mark an additional bubble denoting which party primary they're voting in. If the second bubble is not marked, officials say the vote doesn't count. It's unclear how many votes for presidential candidates may have gone uncounted. In news from Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans have blocked a bid by Democrats to add $44 billion to the $161 billion economic stimulus plan. Senate Democrats attempted to add the additional money to help the elderly, disabled veterans, the unemployed, and businesses, but supporters of the bill fell a single vote short of the 60 needed to move the measure forward. Both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama voted to expand the economic stimulus plan. John McCain missed the vote, even though he was in Washington at the time. Attorneys for the Bush administration urged a federal judge earlier this week to dismiss a lawsuit accusing a subsidiary of Boeing of helping the CIA secretly transport prisoners to overseas torture chambers. The Bush administration claims the lawsuit against Jepson International Trip Planning risks exposing state secrets. The lawsuit accused Jepson of arranging at least 70 flights since 2001 as part of the CIA's Extraordinary Rendition Program. Meanwhile, the United Nations top torture investigator has criticized the Bush administration for defending the use of waterboarding. Manfred Nowak, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, said, quote, "This is absolutely unacceptable under international human rights law." Nowak's comment came one day after CIA Director Michael Hayden acknowledged that three prisoners were waterboarded in 2002 and 2003. On Wednesday, White House spokesperson Tony Fratto said CIA interrogators would use waterboarding again with the president's approval. Attorney General Michael Mukasey is expected to be questioned about waterboarding today when he appears before the House Judiciary Committee. Lawmakers are also planning to question Mukasey about how former Attorney General John Ashcroft received a government contract worth as much as $52 million to monitor out-of-court settlements between prosecutors and corporations. New Jersey's top federal prosecutor, Christopher Christie, recently awarded the contract to Ashcroft. Meanwhile, Attorney General Mukasey is urging Congress to block a plan to give thousands of federal prisoners jailed on crack cocaine offenses a chance to reduce their sentences. Mukasey said, quote, "Many of these offenders are among the most serious and violent offenders in the federal system, and their early release would produce tragic but predictable results." Last year, the U.S. Sentencing Commission voted to reduce the sentences in an attempt to offset the disparity in sentences involving crack cocaine and powder cocaine. Under current law, possession of 5 grams of crack cocaine triggers the same mandatory minimum sentence as possession of 500 grams of powder cocaine. The Associated Press has revealed new details about how the U.S. military is running a secret prison at Guantanamo known as Camp 7. For the first time, the top commander of detention operations at Guantanamo, Rear Admiral Mark Busby, has confirmed the existence of the mysterious prison. The military is reportedly holding 15 so-called high-value detainees at Camp 7. But the military has refused to disclose where Camp 7 is located within the grounds of Guantanamo. Turkey's continuing to carry out bombing raids in Kurdish areas of northern Iraq. On Monday, Turkish F-16 fighter planes reportedly bombed 77 targets during a 12-hour bombing raid. Iraqi villagers were reportedly unable to flee the bombing because heavy snow had closed many roads. Meanwhile, hundreds of Kurdish residents of Turkey gathered on the Iraq border Tuesday to protest the airstrikes. The activists from the pro-Kurdish Democratic Society Party called for a peaceful solution to the conflict between the Turkish state and Kurdish rebels who seek autonomy. In Gaza, 6 Palestinians, including a teacher, were killed today after Israeli tanks and aircraft opened fire in another cross-border raid. The teacher died when an Israeli surface-to-surface missile struck an agricultural school in the northern town of Beit Hanun. On Wednesday, 2 Israeli girls were injured after being hit by a rocket fired from Gaza. In West Virginia, a 46-year-old woman has been indicted on hate crime charges in the case of Megan Williams. Williams is the 20-year-old African-American woman who was kidnapped and tortured last year. Prosecutors say she was held for days in a trailer where she was sexually assaulted, stabbed, and forced to eat animal feces. 6 people have been arrested in the case, but Karen Burton of Chapmanville, West Virginia, is the first to be charged with a hate crime. The death toll in the South has risen to at least 55 following the devastating tornadoes that hit Tennessee, Arkansas, Kentucky, and Alabama on Tuesday. It was the deadliest barrage of tornadoes in the country since 1985. The White House has announced President Bush will tour damaged areas on Friday.
It's a bad storm that affected a lot of people in a variety of states. Administration is reaching out to state officials. I just called the governors of the affected states. I wanted them to know that this government will help them. But more importantly, I wanted them to be able to tell the people in their states that the American people hold them up and hold those who suffer up in prayer. Loss of life, a lot of loss of property. Prayers can help, and so can the government.
In Maryland, 24 high school students were arrested Wednesday on the steps of the State House while protesting cuts in school funding. The students traveled to Annapolis to call for Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley to be arrested for failing to address what they described as a historic underfunding of public schools in Maryland. In other election news, the Green Party held several primaries Tuesday. In California, over 25,000 party members cast ballots in the largest Green Party primary. Ralph Nader won about 61% of the vote. Former Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney placed second with 25%. Nader's name was placed on the ballot even though he's not declared his candidacy. In Arkansas, where Nader was not on the ballot, McKinney received 21% of the vote, but 54% of Green Party members voted uncommitted. And the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi has died at the age of 91. He became famous in the 1960s after the Beatles traveled to his ashram in India to study transcendental meditation techniques. This is John Haglin of the Maharishi University of Management.
Maharishi was extremely special in this world. He's left a huge legacy. He's the one who brought meditation to the world. He's the one who encouraged scientific research on the effects of meditation 50 years ago, which brought meditation out of the realm of mysticism and into the light of mainstream science, mainstream society.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Juan, your thoughts after Super Tuesday?
Well, I've been covering the election as most of everyone else in journalism has. And I think the most important number that came out of Tuesday's election was the total votes in all of these primaries. I think you mentioned that 14.6 million people voted for either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. A total of 8.3 million voted for one of the three remaining Republican candidates. That means that two people voted Democratic for every one that voted Republican on Tuesday. An enormous difference in the turnout votes, which I think augurs well for the Democratic Party in November, assuming that the Democrats stay united, because there is clearly much more enthusiasm among voters who are voting Democratic than those who are voting Republican. Of course, the vote has been split dramatically between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama right down the middle. And it's astonishing the differences in the voters in terms of the makeup of the voters. Clearly, if you are Hispanic, if you're low income, if you're a woman, and if you're elderly, you are much more likely to vote for Hillary Clinton. And if you're young, if you're African American, if you're a man, if you're higher income, you're much more likely to vote for Barack Obama. There's an enormous divide in the Democratic Party. And as Howard Dean has said yesterday, he doesn't want to see this go all the way to the convention, because then the convention, the preparation of the Democrats for November would be severely hampered, so that there will be, I think, increasingly a call for a united candidacy. Of course, the question of who is the president and who is the vice president will continue to be the battle. But I think that no matter what the polls say about who John McCain fares better about, we all know what the polls said 6 months ago about who would fare better for president in both parties. So polls right now for what will happen 6 months from now mean nothing. The question is, does the Democratic electorate stay with the same enthusiasm all the way through to November, or does it begin to eat itself in the continuing battle?
Well, let's talk about what they're arguing over, and that is the delegates and the superdelegates.
Yes. Well, Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have emerged from Super Tuesday in a virtual dead heat in the race for the Democratic nomination. Both camps are looking ahead to a fierce battle for delegates, and neither candidate is likely to emerge as a clear front runner anytime soon. The Democratic nomination requires support from 2,025 delegates. According to an analysis by the New York Times, Clinton has a slight edge with 892 delegates to 716 for Obama. This count includes pledged delegates, those who won in a state, a primary or caucus, and so-called superdelegates, Democrats who are governors, senators, and party leaders who can vote for whomever they want. The narrow margin prompted concern on Wednesday from the chairman of the Democratic Party, Howard Dean. He told cable news channel New York One that if no clear nominee emerged by the middle of March or April, quote, we're going to have to get the candidates together and make some kind of an arrangement, because I don't think we can afford to have a brokered convention. That would not be good news for either party.
Both the Obama and Clinton camps now look ahead to 13 nominating contests over the next month, including Louisiana, Maine, Nebraska, and Washington State this weekend, Maryland and Virginia Tuesday, Wisconsin the week after that. For more on the Democratic race, return to David Rode, a professor of political science at Duke University, joining us on the line from Durham, North Carolina. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Professor Rode.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
Can you explain this issue of delegates, superdelegates, regular delegates, and why it's so hard to even find out how many each of the candidates have won so far?
Okay. Starting with the regular delegates in the Democratic Party, about 80% of the delegates for the convention, as was said, slightly over 4,000 delegates total. About 80% of those are allocated directly by the voters through the primaries and caucuses that each state holds. This is a legacy of the reforms that the Democratic Party instituted after the 1968 convention and the riots in Chicago and things like that to try and put more power in the hands of rank-and-file voters in terms of the selection of delegates instead of having it done by party bosses, which was the way it was before. Then, after a few elections with that experience, the Democrats decided that while that was the general tilt they wanted to have, they also wanted to make sure that party leaders and office holders got to participate in the convention and in the nominating process. And so in 1984, they created this system that's come to be called superdelegates, which simply means that there are a set of delegates, about 20%, or precisely 796 this time around, who are delegates by virtue of the office that they hold automatically. So all the members of the Democratic National Committee, all of the Democratic members of the U.S. House, all the Democrats in the U.S. Senate, all Democratic governors, and a handful of former office holders like former President Clinton, former President Carter, former Vice President Gore, et cetera. The big difference for our purposes is that the delegates that are allocated through primaries and caucuses are committed to their candidates, partly by virtue of the decisions of voters and partly by the fact that the candidates themselves get to approve who the delegates are. The superdelegates aren't committed to anybody. They are designed to be and actually are free agents who get to decide for themselves who they're going to support. And that gets us back to the question that you ask of why it's so hard to find out who these people are supporting. First of all, they have to have made a decision, which many of them haven't. And secondly, they have to be willing to announce it publicly, which many of them aren't.
Now, I'd like to ask you also about the differences between the caucus delegates and the primary delegates, because obviously on Tuesday there were quite a few caucus states as well as primary states, and Barack Obama won many of the caucus states, especially out west. What's the differences in terms of the delegates from caucus states or primary states in terms of their selection?
There's no difference after the fact. The delegates have the same status, and they're basically the same kinds of people. They're people who are personally loyal in one way or another to the candidates. What's really different is about the process by which they're selected. That is, a primary is just like an election. We go into the voting booth, stop for a couple of minutes, cast our ballot, and walk out. Caucuses are, as we saw in Iowa, they're meetings of party people, and they go on for a length of time. They often make decisions about other things than the allocation of national convention delegates to candidates. But the big difference is that they tend to be very small and much lower participation than in primaries. So that's how the Obama people were able to dominate the delegate selection in caucuses, is that they turned out a lot more of their people for the caucuses than the Clinton people did for their candidate.
Professor Rohde, what happens if both candidates go into the convention with about the same number of delegates? And what about Howard Dean's comment that this just can't be a brokered convention? A deal has to be made beforehand.
Well, let me say at the outset that I think a brokered convention is unlikely, not impossible, not inconceivable, but unlikely, merely because we're down to two candidates. And so as we saw on Super Tuesday, it is possible for the two candidates to almost precisely split the number of delegates, but that would have to happen sort of all the way down to the convention. And that, I think, more likely is that one candidate will open up a small but significant lead, and so that may lead to some sort of resolution. However, I must say I'm not at all sure what Howard Dean calling the candidates together and trying to get them to come to an agreement is likely to accomplish. I mean, each of these people want the nomination. Each of them will press for it and try to achieve it. And I think the only thing that's going to make one back out is that they become convinced that they're not going to be successful.
And when you say the unlikelihood that it will go to the convention, clearly the issue of if it is a very close vote, then you do have the potentially divisive battle over whether the Florida delegates and the Michigan delegates would be seated at the convention. And obviously that would begin to create enormous a divisive battle within the Democratic Party, but among Democrats in Florida and Michigan. Wouldn't it?
Oh, yes. I think that has the potential to be something very bad, and that's something else that the Democratic National Committee is trying to work out. There's a proposal now, and this, I think, might bear fruit, for both Michigan and Florida to hold party caucuses for the selection of delegates, perhaps in April or May. And if they can get the state parties to agree to that, that would be a way of allocating delegates and choosing delegates for Florida and Michigan that would not involve a big fight at the convention.
David Rohde, I want to thank you very much for being with us, professor of political science at Duke University in North Carolina. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, Philip Zelikow, as well as NBC News' Robert Windrum and CCR President, Center for Constitutional Rights President Michael Ratner. Stay with us. Faisal Khalifa. Scream. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're broadcasting on over 650 stations, on NPR and Pacifica stations, on low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take. Over 150 stations are. Juan?
Well, CIA Director Michael Hayden acknowledged Tuesday that the agency had used the interrogation technique known as waterboarding on three individuals since the attacks of September 11th. Hayden also claimed the CIA has practiced what he called enhanced interrogation techniques on one-third of the around 100 prisoners he says have been detained. Hayden made the admission in testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Let me make it very clear and to state so officially in front of this committee that waterboarding has been used on only three detainees. It was used on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, it was used on Abu Zubaydah, and it was used on Nashiri. CIA has not used waterboarding for almost 5 years. Okay. We used it against these three high-value detainees because of the circumstances of the time. Very critical to those circumstances was the belief that additional catastrophic attacks against the homeland were imminent.
All three men that Hayden admitted had been subjected to waterboarding are named in the final 9/11 Commission report. The commission relied on information obtained from a number of suspected al-Qaeda members in U.S. captivity, only 10 of whom are mentioned by name. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, in particular, emerges in the report as the, quote, principal architect of the 9/11 attacks. An NBC investigation released last week alleges that the commission had long suspected the information used for its report was a product of harsh interrogations. The NBC analysis shows that more than a quarter of all footnotes in the 9/11 Commission report refer to controversial interrogation techniques. Yet commission staffers did not question the CIA about its techniques. They even ordered a second round of interrogations in early 2004 to get more information from the detainees.
Philip Zelikow was the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. He's now professor of history and director of the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. He joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia. We're also joined here in the Firehouse studio in New York by Robert Windrum, NBC News investigative reporter who co-authored the analysis of the 9/11 Commission report, and by Michael Ratner, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Robert Windrum, why don't you lay out what you discovered?
Well, what we looked at, we started to take a look early on in this, not as part of a story that actually evolved, but we looked at what can you find out from the footnotes from the 9/11 Commission report on the interrogations, because it is the single most detailed record of what can be found on the interrogations. Obviously, there's no CIA reports on this, but since the commission so deeply relied on it, we figured, well, let's just go through it. And as we began to look, the detail began to emerge, the numbers began to emerge, and also the critical information, it became quite clear, had come from the interrogations. And so we decided at that point, well, let's just run through some Excel spreadsheets, see what we get. And ultimately, we came out with what Juan had said. About a quarter of the commission's footnotes rely in some way on the interrogation reports. And the footnotes, by the way, are very specific. They give the individual who was interrogated. They talk what date. And also, if you can refer back to the text, and in some cases within the footnote itself, what they provided. And so it does show that the commission absolutely needed these this detail in order to proceed with its report, and also after talking to a number of people, both within the CIA and within the commission, that there was no real discussion of interrogation techniques that were used in order to provide this. And in fact, several people we talked to, three people we talked to on the commission staff, including Mr. Zelikow, said that yes, they had guessed or suspected that harsh interrogation techniques were used, but they did not go forward because it was not part of their mission.
They didn't question.
They did not question that.
And you're saying that they ordered a second round.
There was a second round.
These interrogations.
If you go through the footnotes,
the commission,
and the commission and the agency both told us this, or commission staffers and agency staffers both told us this, that essentially the first round of interrogations were needed to look for what were the impending attacks, they were sort of prospective questioning, whereas the second round that was called for was essentially to fill in details, more retrospective, on what happened on 9/11. And these took place in early 2004. And there were, from what we could trace through the footnotes, about 30 of them, 30 separate sessions that took place during that period of time.
And Philip Zelikow, your response, and also about this issue of whether you saw it as your mission to look at whether how the interrogations and the answers to the questions of those prisoners were obtained.
Well, of course, we questioned CIA about how the information was obtained. I mean, the notion that we didn't ask CIA how they questioned these people would strike anyone in the government now as being deeply ironic, because they're currently under a federal criminal investigation probing exactly how they answered our questions about the way the interrogations were conducted. We asked for information about the context, about the circumstances under which the questions were asked, about the specific kinds of questions that were asked, about the demeanor of the interrogators and the people who were being interrogated. We asked a host of specific questions repeatedly and in writing from CIA. And then when we were not satisfied with CIA's answers to those questions, we spotlighted our concerns in a text box in our report that transparently stated, here are our concerns about the nature of this material. We're going to sift and evaluate it as best we can, even though CIA won't tell us all the details we wanted to know, and even though CIA and the administration refused to give us the direct access to the detainees that we then requested.
Did you know that these questions were obtained under duress, under torture?
We did not know that. We could see that they were extremely reluctant to tell us about the circumstances, and therefore we could only assume that they felt they had something that they wished they didn't want the commission to know about.
Did you ask if they were obtained through torture?
We asked how they were obtained.
And what were you told?
We were told we can't tell you that.
Now,
we asked those questions. That's why when the disclosure came out about the CIA tape recordings, people immediately said, well, did the commission ask for information of this kind? And we immediately prepared a report, which I did actually for Tom Kaine and Lee Hamilton, which has been leaked to the New York Times and is available on the internet, that details exactly how thoroughly we questioned CIA about the information surrounding these interrogations. And CIA's alleged withholding of information from us is currently one of the subjects of the federal criminal investigation that's now underway.
Now, I'd be interested to know what kind of discussion went on among the staff and the commission members once you were rebuffed in certain ways by the CIA in giving you a clear sense of how they obtained the information, whether there was discussion to try to seek to talk to some of these detainees directly by the commission or to battle over that issue.
Both. And actually, my report to Kaine and Hamilton, which, as I say, was leaked by someone in the government to the New York Times and is available on the internet, actually gives the specific details about our efforts to both press the administration generally on this issue. And that issue, by the way, went all the way up to discussions directly between Kaine and Hamilton and George Tenet, and then was escalated past that to further discussions involving Lee Hamilton with White House Counsel Gonzalez, George Tenet, and Don Rumsfeld, in which they simply flatly said, we can't give you the access to the interrogators that you want, and we can't give you the access to the detainees that you want. If there are some particular follow-up questions you want to pose to try to clarify some of the inconsistencies and contradictions in the information you are getting, we're happy to forward those questions on to the interrogators, but we won't let you talk to the people yourselves in order to evaluate the information. Understand, the commission is operating under a specific statutory mandate from Congress. Our mandate from Congress was to find out the facts and circumstances surrounding the 9/11 attacks. Therefore, we tried to get all the information that would help us do that. And when we got the information from these interrogations, we were dissatisfied with its quality and detail. And we listed our dissatisfactions repeatedly and in writing to the government. We then followed up with them in a variety of different ways to probe more deeply. But if I can underscore one more point, just so that we don't lose perspective on this, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib bragged on Al Jazeera about carrying out the 9/11 attacks before they were captured. So I don't think that there is a significant question as to whether or not they are truthfully claiming to be involved in these attacks. They said that before they were caught.
Michael Ratner, you're the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Your response.
You know, when Robert called me to talk about this story and what he had found, essentially the key chapters being based substantially on evidence from torture, I actually was really shocked by it. I mean, I didn't know that. I work in this field, and I didn't know that. And I was shocked by it because we all know that our own court cases have said evidence from torture is not reliable. And here you have a report that's supposed to tell us what actually happened in its key chapters on the planning of 9/11, what actually happened when the people came into the country, and you look at those footnotes, and they're based on torture. What it has to tell you is to be very, very skeptical about a number of the conclusions in that report. You just can't rely on evidence of torture. We all know that. Think about it. If the Bhutto assassination, if the government of Pakistan issued a report and we knew it came out of torture, would any of us be sitting at this table believing it? Would we believe that about the assassination of Kennedy if it came out of tortured people? No, we wouldn't. Why are we accepting this? That's not saying it's not true, but it's saying we have a big problem here now because we have evidence of torture. The second response I have, and it's really to Phil, is if he suspected torture, when he went back for that second round of questioning, didn't you expect that they might continue to do torture to get answers from people? And isn't that sort of putting the commission in a place where it's really sort of the handmaiden of continuing torture? I mean, I was really, really shocked by that. By that time, in early 2004, there was some evidence, and more than some, that torture was being used. We had torture articles about Afghanistan. We had early in that period, we had the Tipton 3 people coming out of Guantanamo talking about torture by March or April. By April 28th, of course, we had Abu Ghraib. And yet the report of the commission comes out after this, comes out, you know, 6 months after those revelations. So it puts the commission, really, I think, and the report in a very, very scary place where it was really based, in my view, on torture. And it's a sad comment.
Philip Zelikow, your response, chair of the 9/11 commission, executive director of the 9/11 commission.
I think Michael Ratner's concerns are legitimate concerns, but I think he overstates the case when he says these footnotes are based on torture, this evidence is based on torture. He doesn't know that. And he doesn't even know that the information from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in these particular interrogation reports came from torture.
We don't know that.
He doesn't know that. No one knows that.
Philip Zelikow, do you know that they didn't?
No, of course I don't know that they didn't, and I don't know that they did. So, what's the obligation here? The obligation is tell the public what you know, tell them how you know it, citing all your sources. If there's some things you don't know about the sources, tell them that too. We did. So now, what's the next? We've given them all the information we can, so that people can write the stories today, raising these questions. And we laid it all out for people to examine, including our citations and our concerns. We pressed the questions about the nature of these interrogations as hard as we possibly could. And the CIA's failure to answer in some cases is now the subject of criminal investigation. So what's the next step? The next step has got to be, then, if you want more reliable information through a trial, then bring the people to trial. I've been an advocate both inside and outside of the government of bringing these people to trial in every possible way. And perhaps a little bit due to my efforts, a couple of years ago, the president decided that those people would be brought out of the black sites and brought to trial. And my hope is that when they are eventually brought to trial, we'll have a chance to gather more information, perhaps through a more adversarial process, and check on some of the assertions. But if people will look at the footnotes carefully and look at the way they're used in the report, we took into account some concerns. We tried to get multiple sources of information on controversial points that we thought might be questionable. Where we thought the detainees might not be truthful, we say so. We rely heavily on information from the German investigations in Hamburg, from the Spanish investigations in Spain, from information gathered in the largest criminal investigation ever conducted in the history of the United States to reconstruct the forensic evidence on all this. And, of course, Philip the Zalko, televised if I, confessions if I can, I'd just like to, of bin Laden and KSM.
Philip Zalko, if I can, I just like to bring in Robert Windrum again on this issue of he says that basically the commission disclosed all of the sources of its information, and it was there for anyone to see. In your report, what did you conclude on
there,
that?
There is, and Mr. Zalko pointed this out to me, as did two of his former staffers, that there is on page 146 of the commission report a description of why they decided to use the interrogation information. Wherein that box, as it's referred to, has some information about their concerns, it does not state that they had concerns about these interrogations being undertaken with duress. It did not state that specifically. And talking to Mr. Zalko and talking to two of his former staffers, they did express at that time certain concerns about, and as Mr. Zalko said to me, they guessed that there was harsh interrogation techniques used. There is a general description on that box on page 146 of their concerns, but it does not go specifically to the issue that we're discussing here today, which is whether these interrogations took place under duress. And that was certainly something that there were internal discussions on within the commission staff.
We're going to come back to this point in a minute. We have to break. We're talking to Philip Zalko. He is the executive director of 9/11 Commission, now professor at University of Virginia. Robert Windrum, NBC News investigative reporter who broke the story on the 9/11 Commission report and how much of it is based on torture, on information that was obtained under torture. And Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're talking about an NBC report. You can go to msnbc.deepbackground.com to get more information on the report that says that about a quarter of the footnotes, was it, Robert Windrum? The footnotes of the 9/11 report were based on coercive interrogations of prisoners. Robert Windrum is our guest, NBC News investigative reporter, Michael Ratner, Center for Constitutional Rights. And we're joined in Charlottesville, Virginia, by the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, Philip Zelikow. Michael Ratner, I cut you off just before break. Your response?
Well, I was a bit surprised to hear Phil say that you can't assume that the evidence that he had from the interrogations was based on torture. Can I say it 100%? No. But you can say that he based it on Zubaydah, colleague Sheikh Mohammed, and others who we now know were waterboarded. And they're the evidence that's used. So you put two and two together, you get four. You get the fact, essentially, that these people were tortured to get their testimony. And a question that Phil didn't answer for me is, really, when he went back for the next round of 30 questions, did he think that torture might be used to get those answers? And when he had his meeting, which he had with Kane and Hamilton and Tenet, he sat in the room for a number of meetings with Tenet, the head of the CIA, asking about access to the witnesses. Did he ask Tenet whether these people were tortured?
Philip Zelikow, did you ask Tenet whether these people were tortured?
I did not, but that wasn't—I wasn't the person who was pushing the issue directly with Tenet. That was more the job of my bosses and the commission, Tom Kane, Lee Hamilton, and other commissioners.
And did they question George Tenet directly? Did they ask him, were these prisoners tortured?
They did not ask him, as far as I know. And you know, they were present in meetings I didn't attend. But as far as I know, they did not ask him directly what interrogation methods had been used. They asked, they said, we need all the details surrounding this questioning. We need to know how these people were questioned. We need much more details. We want to talk to the interrogators. We want to talk to the people themselves so that we can ourselves assess the credibility of these accounts that we are using.
Robert Windrum, let me put a question to Robert Windrum. This issue of the prisoners now saying that they were tortured, coming before a Pentagon tribunal, four of them saying they gave the information only to stop the torture?
At least four, because there was large sections of the testimony of the combatant status review tribunals that was redacted by the Pentagon. Those sections invariably were sections about torture interrogation methods, however you want to describe it. But at least four of them said, indeed, that they had provided information only as a result of being tortured, and they used the word torture. They did not use enhanced interrogation techniques. They said torture. And two of them, as I recall, said that they recanted what they had said during those interrogations because it was not the truth. And Abu Zubaydah, in particular, went into detail as to what he had said under torture and what he was now recanting. So you do have now the other issue of a public record, once again, the combatant status tribunal hearing record, which says that there was torture and also that, indeed, it led to false testimony.
I'd like to ask you, Philip Zelikow, on the issue of the book by Philip Shannon, The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, raises obviously some disturbing criticism in addition about the commission's work. I was struck in particular by the questions he raised about your communications with Karl Rove during that period, and also that the issue of whether you sought to have your secretary remove the logs of your phone calls with Karl Rove during that period. Could you respond to those issues raised by Shannon?
Well, not only can I respond to them, the commissioners actually have responded and will respond to anyone who asks them, because I was authorized by the commission to talk to White House officials regularly, as was the general counsel, Dan Marcus. But on this business of Rove, it's a little ironic, since I don't even really know Rove. We had two brief contacts that had to do with University of Virginia business, because I used to direct the Presidential Research Center. In both cases, we handed off the issues to others. The university actually has records on this matter. I told Shannon all of this. The business about phone logs, actually, two of the three people who took my calls don't even remember this story. This appears to be a garble having to do with whether the message slips would be left out on the counter.
Well, let me ask you directly this very straightforward allegation of Philip Sheehan, that he said that you called in your secretary, shut the door, informed her she was no longer to keep phone logs of your contacts with the White House. She got so alarmed that she went, thinking it was improper, that she went to the chief lawyer for the commission to alert him about what's happened. Did you tell her not to keep logs of your White House calls?
If someone will just go talk to the chief lawyer of the commission, you don't have to rely on my account of this. I mean, there are other people who have knowledge of these facts, and there's no there there.
You did not tell her not to keep logs?
There are no phone logs for the commission. There are no phone. The commission had no phone logs. So I couldn't tell her not to keep logs in a situation where the commission didn't have phone logs.
But she kept your logs.
She kept your logs. I did not have any phone logs.
So you're saying you did not. This is a completely fabricated story.
This is a garble of something that's probably come two or three layers removed from people who don't actually understand the way our office worked. But no one in the office thought that I was concealing anything from the commissioners, and the commissioners don't think I was concealing anything from them, because they were briefed on all these contacts.
Well, they're...
And they also knew very well what my relationship with the White House was, since, as the commissioners have recently put it, Zellico was the White House's biggest problem. And the commissioners, if you just call them and ask them, will point out that I was actually a source of constant trouble for the White House, and the White House had hoped that the commission would put someone else in my job. And, in fact, the White House's biggest supporters, like Bill Sapphire, were slamming me in their columns during 2004 because I was leading the commission to knock down the theories they supported.
There appears to be, at least according to Sheehan, one commissioner, Mr. Zellico, Max Cleland, who did raise questions about what was happening in the commission, and he was removed, according to Sheehan, because of his, or shortly after raising his criticisms of what he thought were cover-ups occurring in the commission, he was removed. Is there any accuracy to that Sheehan claim?
He was not removed. Max resigned from the commission. There are commissioners who know very well the circumstances of Max's resignation. And if anyone wants to know more about this, she should talk to either Max or Tom Daschle or the commissioners involved, because Max resigned on his own and quite voluntarily for very personal reasons that commissioners know about, but which I was not a part of at all.
One of the points that Philip Sheehan makes in his book, The Commission, is not only your relationship, your ongoing relationship with Rove, but with Condoleezza Rice, which went way back before the commission, of course, that
May
you co-authored
you,
a book
though,
with her.
When you say my ongoing relationship with Karl Rove, I had no ongoing relationship with Karl Rove. I've never worked with Karl Rove. I've never had any political dealings with Karl Rove at all in my life. So this is... Your question just kind of assumes things that just aren't true.
He talks about conversations that you had with Karl Rove at the White House, and also a longtime relationship with Condoleezza Rice, and talks about in the book, he talks about how the staff felt pressured, and that any negative references to Condoleezza Rice in her role in the lead-up to the 9/11 attacks was whitewashed in the report because of pressure from you, her friend, her co-author, longtime colleague.
But, you know, Shannon doesn't say that.
Well, he does argue.
Shannon doesn't say the report was. Excuse me. Shannon does not say the report was whitewashed, quote unquote. No,
well, let me say that he talks about the pressure that high-level staffers felt when talking, when writing about Condoleezza Rice.
Oh. Well, why don't you, you or any journalist, should call up the high-level staffers and ask them, and ask them whether or not they felt that they were bullied or pressured. The leader of that team, who worked in the Clinton White House, I'll add, has gone on the record with the Associated Press saying that their team did not feel bullied in any way at all. He's happy to talk to any reporter about this. Another member of the staff who plays a very prominent role in Shannon's account wrote to all the commissioners, reached out to all of them, and described Shannon's account as, quote, a case study in hype, close quote. But journalists who want to check this out, go talk to them. You don't have to take my word for it. Go ask them if they felt pressured. Of course, the irony in all of this was at the time, the White House's supporters were denouncing me, and here, 3.5 years later, I'm being attacked from the other side. Well, the commissioners themselves don't feel that they were in the commissioners feel that they understood exactly how I was running the commission staff and how I was doing the work. They had they had transparency into what was going on, and I think they can speak for themselves now on the final product.
What Shannon argues,
never
what he argues,
that any key facts were left out of the report.
What he argues is that you sought to intimidate staff to avoid damaging findings for President Bush, who at the time was running for re-election, as well as references to Condoleezza Rice in any damaging way.
He says sought to intimidate, quote
yes,
unquote.
Yes, this is what Shannon alleges in the commission in his new book.
Well, anyone who was in the White House at the time would find that accusation ridiculous. But as I say, talk to the staffers. Ask them. Ask them if they thought that I was trying to intimidate them. The leader of the team is happy to talk to any reporters who will ask. What I'm trying to do is I don't want to get in an argument where I'm saying, you know, Shannon says this, Zellico says that. If you don't have to trust me or take my word for it. Go to the commissioners. Go to the staffers, many of whom worked for Democratic administrations. I worked for 1 month on a transition team.
Philip Zellico, we're going to have to leave it there because we're at the end of the broadcast. But I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the 9/11 Commission, former Executive Director, now Professor at University of Virginia, Robert Rindrum of NBC News, and Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for